to talk about an admittedly somewhat wacky theory of gravity. So if you're up for that, then that's what I'm going to be speaking about. So it's Yang-Mills conformal gravity I'm going to be talking about. It's some work I've done in collaboration with Jack Gegenberg at UNB in New Brunswick, and our PhD student, Shura Ramadi, who we're co-supervising. So it is an alternative theory of gravity. It's a different theory of gravity than general relativity, and it has some interesting features, which I'm going to try and tell you about today.
Sorry, stupid question.
Yeah?
You just done it so right that you have the same identifier?
Oh, that's got to be a typo. Yeah, it can't possibly be. I think I copied it over and then I didn't change the last digits, one would assume. Yeah, the first one's in PRD and the second one's sitting at some editor's desk somewhere. Okay, so it's a bit of motivation. Special relativity. We all know special relativity is a theory of mechanics that's partly inspired by the Lorentz symmetry of electromagnetism. So we all know Lorentz electromagnetism is a theory that has a Lorentz symmetry. It means things like the speed of light should be constant in every inertial reference frame. So when you have a fact like the speed of light is constant in every inertial reference frame, you might want to incorporate that into your theory of mechanics, which was Newtonian mechanics up until Einstein introduced special relativity, which was a theory of mechanics that respected this fact that there was a universal speed limit and things like the speed of light were constant in every reference frame. So you can think of special relativity as a theory with a global Lorentz symmetry inspired by that symmetry of electromagnetism. So similarly, general relativity is a generalization of special relativity, where instead of having this global Lorentz symmetry, which is your arena of physics, you have a local Lorentz symmetry. General relativity is a theory of geometry where you recover Lorentz symmetry locally or on small patches, but it's still there as a local symmetry of the theory, and you get a theory of gravitation that we all know and we're interested in. But it's kind of interesting to notice that electromagnetism is a theory that has more than Lorentz symmetry going on with it. It's invariant under a wider group of symmetries than either special relativity or general relativity. It doesn't just have, it's not just invariant under the Lorentz group. So it's actually invariant under the full conformal group, SO42. So what's that conformal group? It consists of the Poincaré group of special relativity that consists of rotations and translations. So I've just drawn the action of the Poincaré group on some grid of points like this. And the rotations, if they're understood in a suitable four-dimensional sense, are the Lorentz boosts that we're familiar with. But electromagnetism is also invariant under an extra conformal symmetry. So it's also invariant under dilatations or transformations that squish or stretch this grid and make it smaller. And it's also invariant under these things called special conformal transformations, which are admittedly weird things where you take points and you reflect them or you invert them over the unit circle, perform a translation, and invert them back. And you find that this is a symmetry of electromagnetism as well. And together, all these things make the group SO42, the conformal group. That's actually a special conformal transformation. They should be. Some of them are not. Yeah, that might be a plotting effect. Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, it should be. Yeah, I'll check that code there, but it's supposed to preserve angles, yeah, because it's a conformal transformation. So the idea here is to construct a gravitational theory with conformal symmetries similar to electromagnetism, or can you construct a gravitational theory that incorporates some of these other symmetries that electromagnetism has? So the earliest proposal along this line was a conformal gravity proposal by Weyl in 1918. It was part of an attempt to construct a unified gravity theory of gravity and electromagnetism. And the action of that was fairly straightforward. It was a conformally invariant action you take by taking the Weyl tensor and squaring it, and you construct a gravitational theory like this. This is the gravitational part of your action, and then over here you have the matter part of your action like so. So that was suggested by Weil a long time ago, and it's recently been studied, in the last 15 years, been revived by Mannheim and his collaborators, and a lot of the implications of this theory are known. And the theory that I'm going to present to you has some features similar to this, but it also has some key differences. Now, this is not the way that we're going to go. We're going to take another approach, and it's the approach of so-called Yang-Mills gravity. So how does Yang-Mills gravity work? Well, here you've got to choose a gauge group when you're constructing a Yang-Mills theory. So I'm going to take the group SO42 like this, which has 15 generators of translations, special conformals, rotations, and dilations like that. And I'm going to construct a Yang-Mills theory out of these generators. So the method is the same always. You take some linear combination of these generators, like so, and you call that your vector potential, where each of these things are supposed to depend on position within some sort of space. They're functions. The coefficients of the linear combination are functions. Once you've got a vector potential like this, you can define the field strength of that vector potential in the usual way.
Where is the generator of a special conformal?
The k's.
Okay.
Yeah, there's the k's right there. Can you read that? The Lorentz are in these rotations here, yeah. The Lorentz boosts are, so this would be the translations, just translations in the form. Four indices, yeah. So the Latin indices are like the internal index, and alpha is the space-time index. Capital A is the index that runs a 1 to 15 over these generators, but I partition them off in an appropriate way. Okay, so you'd write down the field strength in the usual way, and here you have the structure constants of your group given by the commutator of those of the generators like that. And then finally what you do is you write down the Yang-Mills action for this field strength like so. So given this field strength tensor, the simplest kind of action you could write out of that is quadratic in the field strength like so. You tie up the indices with the metric on your manifold, and you also tie up the internal index, H alpha beta, with the Cartan-Killing metric on your group like so, defined in this way. So it's a function of the structure constants like that. So this is the Yang-Mills action for this particular gauge group.
So is this different from the you just said it's a trace of FS squared. Is that the same as this?
It's the same thing. So, it's the same thing. So I'm lying to you a little bit. This is not a compact group, so this trace operation doesn't actually make sense. But this definition in terms of structure constants is what we've taken over. So there's no matrix representation. This is a non-compact group. Okay. Yep.
So this is maybe field is induced by the
connection. Yeah, I'll just show you right now. So far right now I've got just Yang-Mills theory in curved space, and like that's not really gravitational theory. To get a good theory of gravity, what we've got to do is start identifying some components of this gauge vector geometrically. So for example, you can see here the coefficient of translations, EA alpha. Well, I'm going to associate that with the tetrad on some manifold. So I'm going to use that EA alpha and contract it in a way to give me the metric on some four-dimensional manifold. So that's my identification of this degree of freedom gives me the metric on some four manifold. Similarly, this omega AB alpha is going to be associated with the connection one forms on my manifold. So I've got a tetrad in space like that, and when it moves from position to position, I need a rule to move a tetrad from here to here. That rule is furnished by these connection one forms that tell us how we go from place to place. And that's what I'm going to associate with this component of my gauge vector.
What's ECV?
Where am
ECV?
ECB?
Yeah.
See, it's just the tetrad there. So this is the covariant derivative of a tetrad vector is given by some linear combination over the tetrad vectors at that point, and those coefficients are the spin connection. It's just the spin connection. Any other questions? This covariant derivative is the appropriate covariant derivative to use with an object with space-time and tetrad indices. Ladin A and B are raised and lowered by the Minkowski metric in this. Okay, omega is anti-symmetric in these two indices because the generators of rotations are anti-symmetric in those two indices, which means that if I'm identifying this as the connection on my manifold, I've got a metric compatible connection, which just means that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero, as usual. However, it's not necessarily torsion-free. So if I define, if all I'm assuming and all that I'm supposed to assume is anti-symmetry on those indices, I can end up with an affine connection that has torsion. So for example, you take two covariant derivatives of a scalar in a torsion-free manifold, they commute. You can take them in either order, but when you have a manifold with torsion, they do not commute. So that is a possibility that I've got here. Metric compatible and not necessarily torsion free.
Can I ask one question? So is the idea that these P, K, J, and B are some fixed operators, and then these E, L, omega, and Q are dynamical?
Yeah, that's the kind of idea there. Although when I write down the action here, all those generators have gone because I've taken various contractions of them and they've been, we saw the trace operation there. They're all hiding in this Catan killing metric thing. So the algebra of the group is not something that changes from place to place in your manifold. It's not dynamical, it's fixed, just as it would be for the particle physics. Am I going to tell you what they are? I'm going to tell you what their behavior is or what effect they have on the theory. I don't know what they are necessarily, other than the fields that gauge these transformations in this theory.
So to take it this way, like omega and E are not just like arbitrary fields. They have to be related at this point by the relation.
So the coefficients here are the dynamical fields of the theory, which we are interpreting as geometric quantities on a four-manifold.
Okay, but you have some relation that the derivative of E was
Yes, that's part of the interpretation of these fields. That's what's required to make it a sensible geometry out of it. So that's the tetrad postulate that's relating what E and omega are.
Shouldn't that follow from the action?
No, that doesn't follow from the action. That's part of our assumptions here. It's the definition of this operator. So you got, without this, you don't a priori know what that is. Does that make sense? Okay, right. So there's a couple things to keep in mind when analyzing this theory. This looks like Yang-Mills theory in curved space, but it's really not. The reason being is that these metrics that show up here, they're algebraic functions of the gauge potential. So the metric G alpha beta, G alpha mu, depends on this component of the gauge potential just like that. That's not what happens in Yang-Mills theory. In Yang-Mills theory, what you have is these two field strengths just depend on the gauge potential, and these in some sense are background fields, if you want to do it on a fixed background, or if you couple it to the Einstein-Hilbert action, then you get a complete Einstein-Yang-Mills theory. Here we've got something rather different there, and there's going to have some consequences of that. So this isn't just like Yang-Mills, if you're familiar with that. So it's quite unlike Yang-Mills theory in curved space-time. The other thing to keep in mind is that this coupling that shows up here is dimensionless for Yang-Mills theory because of conformal invariance. It's possibly a relevant observation for quantization. There is no dimensionful coupling constant here. I'm not going to discuss that in great detail, but it's one of the original motivations for several people to look at theories of this type, this dimensionless coupling parameter. So as I mentioned, we're not really the only people who have ever done this. That is considered some sort of gravitational theory, or writing down gravitation as some sort of gauge theory. It's been done before with a number of different groups here, gauge groups, that is, the Poincaré group, the de Sitter group, and also the conformal group, which we're doing here. There's been some other groups, the symplectic group as well. So it's been done by all of these particular authors. Actually, Wheeler has considered a similar model to this. What we have done is basically taken the equations of motion and tried to solve them in some interesting contexts. But there's a fairly long history of doing this kind of thing. Okay. So let's just talk about the matter in the model, because what we're going to find out is that the matter is one of the more interesting things. How do we describe matter in this model? So we have that action there. And what we can do is parameterize the matter sources that show up in this model via a current, a Yang-Mills valued current that takes on values in the group. So let's define the current this way, with the variational derivative of the matter Lagrangian with respect to the components of the gauge potential, like so. So when we've defined the matter current this way, we can actually decompose this. This has an index that's part of the gauge group. We can decompose this current in terms of the generators of SO42. So there's a decomposition of the matter current like this. So instead of having just one second rank tensor that describes matter, we have a whole bunch of others. We have a couple of second rank tensors here, something that's third rank, and another something that looks like a vector field like so. So we get a whole bunch of matter fields just because we have additional components or additional components of the gauge vector to which matter could couple.
Assume that matter will also satisfy the same symmetries?
No. So the symmetry, not necessarily. I haven't specified a matter model yet, but we could go both ways at this point. So how do we interpret the components of these matter things? Well, you find out that the B component, the one that sits here and is along the direction of the special conformal transformation, the generators of the special conformal transformation, is basically the ordinary stress energy tensor. So it's given by the variation of the matter Lagrangian with respect to the metric, gives you that stress energy tensor. But you get, as I mentioned, you get these other matter fields. For example, A is related to the variation of the matter action with respect to Ls, which are the fields that gauge the special conformal transformations. You get contributions with variation with respect to the rotation spin connection, and also this Q alpha, which is called in the literature the Weyl vector, like so. So you get a bunch of other matter fields, just representing the fact that there's more for matter to couple to other than just the metric, for example. So we want to keep an open mind and allow for as general matter couplings as possible and see where we can go with that. So now that I've defined the matter current, the equations of motion are look fairly simple. They're written down this way. So what do we have here? We have the gauge covariant derivative of the field strength tensor. That's what's this quantity here. It's defined in terms of the ordinary covariant derivative plus some additional terms with the structure constants, familiar from Yang-Mills theory. This is the matter current that I was talking about before. It's the variation of the matter Lagrangian with respect to A. What's this thing over here? You recall that I told you that this isn't exactly like Yang-Mills because the metric depends on the gauge potential in a way that it doesn't usually. Well, this is the consequence of that, is that this additional current that shows up here is a direct consequence of the fact that the metric depends on the tetrad algebraically, like so. So one thing to notice here that these are second order field equations for the gauge potential. So F involves one derivative of the gauge potential, and then I'm taking another one here, so I get some second order equations for the gauge potential that are fairly complicated when fully expanded out. And I'm not even going to give you the full form of that just now. So we've got a second order theory like so. So I mentioned that it's pretty complicated when it's expanded out, so we want to make it a little bit simpler by gauge fixing. So let's go ahead and do some gauge fixing. This is a gauge theory, so there's some gauge symmetry here. If this was ordinary Yang-Mills theory, this would be invariant under a gauge transformation of this type here, which is generated by a space-time scalar, but something that has SO42 indices, epsilon, like so. So I can choose these things arbitrarily, and if this was ordinary Yang-Mills theory, this action would be invariant under this change of the vector potential. However, this isn't Yang-Mills theory, it's Yang-Mills gravity. The metric also has that dependence on the tetrad, which is part of the gauge potential. So this isn't the full transformation here, it's actually invariant under some smaller class of transformations of that type. Basically, you lose the translations, that part of the gauge symmetry. That's fine. It's still the invariant under some gauge symmetries. And we can use these transformations to try and simplify things. So for example, what we can do is, without loss of generality, we can choose a gauge where we switch off the Q alpha field. So we can actually work consistently in a gauge where this Weyl vector is gauged to zero. And there's still a gauge symmetry left over at the end of that. So at the end of that, if we work in a gauge where Q is equal to zero, we retain a residual gauge symmetry of this type generated by two things there. And we see that we have this omega parameter here, which you can easily verify that this generates conformal transformations, local Weyl transformations on our manifold. And you've also got this lambda matrix left over here, and that's what generates Lorentz transformations or Lorentz frame rotations within our geometry like that. So we've got this residual symmetry that has both conformal transformations, which is unlike general relativity, but it also has Lorentz frame rotations, which general relativity has as well. Yep? The translation symmetry for this group is from the SO42 group is broken, but we've supplanted it with diffeomorphism symmetry. So diffeomorphisms are still here.
So K, D, and D escape in an algebra?
Yeah, it still forms it still forms a closed algebra. Yeah. Okay, so after that partial gauge fixing. After that partial gauge fixing where Q equals zero, I finally will write down the equations of motion. You get four of them here, and they can be labeled by the components of the matter tensor that goes with them. So you get these equations. They're there, they're complicated. They're a lot more complicated than you can see here because I made everything simpler, and it's kind of good that this is fuzzy because they're it's just really horrendous. The equations get fairly crazy. Highlight a few things here. Here's the Ricci tensor shows up over there. The Ricci tensor. There's the Riemann tensor that shows up in various components around here. There's a torsion tensor that again has to do with the fact that the gradients, two gradients of scalar fields don't commute. That shows up over there. Some other quantities that show up as well are this F tensor and script F tensor. This one's anti-symmetric, that's symmetric. It might be worth writing that down because you can't see that there. That's not much better. Okay. Is that better? It's the symmetric part of this combination here. I'm not actually sure if I need this anywhere. And the script F one is the anti-symmetric combination of the tetrad and this L thing over there. So yeah, the equations are complicated, but you can write them out. It's just a tedious exercise. You can confirm explicitly that these equations of motion do have some residual symmetries. They're invariant under local conformal transformations, Weyl transformations. They're also invariant under diffeomorphisms, obviously, because they're written in a tensorial format. Again, that's the symmetries of the right-hand sides. The left-hand sides could be, depends on your matter model there. So assuming, I'm just talking about the symmetry of the right-hand side. Okay, so yeah, grad hat is the ordinary Levi-Civita covariant derivative, the one that's written out in terms of the regular Christoffel connection, whereas this model actually has torsion in it as well. So that's the part including torsion without the hat. So it's much more convenient to write it out in terms of this one, but occasionally we do that. There's a formula with the contortion tensor that matches those guys up. Any other questions? Okay. Right, so we got a complicated awful gravitational theory, so what do you want to do with it? You got to linearize it around flat space and see what happens to make things more straightforward. So let's try and linearize the theory about Minkowski space with no matter. So let me introduce a perturbation variable like that. H alpha beta is supposed to be small. I'm also going to write things in terms of the trace-free part of the perturbation like so. We're going to assume that switch off some of these matter fields. They assume that they vanish before and after perturbation. So I'm not going to consider perturbations with these things non-zero. And I'm also going to consider the torsion-free sector of perturbations just to get myself started. So what do we obtain? The linear equations look like this. Some of them actually look like Maxwell-Klein-Gordon-like equations, like so. So the A field itself, although it's a matter source, seems to satisfy a Klein-Gordon equation, which then in turn sources something that looks like Maxwell equations for this anti-symmetric combination of these guys there. A is the variation of the matter Lagrangian with respect to L. So it's a tensor that characterizes the coupling of matter. I'm assuming some matter fields vanish, so only the C's and the D's. I want to include some matter in here to have something interesting. So I've set those guys equal to zero. There's reasons for that, but and I'm just considering the A and the B fields sitting around. One, of course, could include all of them.
The top line says Minkowski space with no matter. So.
Yeah, okay. So, Minkowski space, the background has no matter, and the matter is introduced perturbatively. So, yeah, you see what I mean? Yeah, it's a vacuum, yeah. Okay, and we also get a fourth order equation for the metric perturbations like this. So once we write down the equation for this trace-free part of the metric perturbation, we get this kind of equation for its evolution like that. And it's fourth order in derivatives of the trace-free part of the metric perturbation like that. And it's sourced by both the A and the B matter fields like so. So you might be nervous because fourth order could be bad news. There could be ghosts and things like that hanging around like so. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that the field equations for the gauge vector are second order. This is a second order theory. We saw that when we explicitly wrote down the theory in terms of the gauge vector. It's in some ways just a fancy Yang-Mills theory, and that doesn't have any ghosts. So what's going on here is when you rewrite the theory in terms of the metric variable, you get these effective fourth order equations, but it's really just hiding the fact that you've got a fundamentally second order theory. And of course, the same thing happens for F of R gravity. So, yep.
Just because you have the answer, doesn't mean you have ghosts, because you have to look at the action second.
an order. And see whether all the characters can come at the same time. So,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. No. So that's why I'm giving you this hand-waving argument. So I haven't looked at the action and expanded it to second order and verified that it's, you know, bounded in the appropriate way. However, but the reason that I thought that this might have happened is because of this fourth order equation. I just point out, though, that fundamentally the theory is second order, so one wouldn't necessarily expect this. Yeah, yeah. The question is,
the problem is usually you have, if you do that, then you have opposite signs.
Yeah.
That's why you have to check the action that you have opposite signs.
Yeah, absolutely. But the lore is kind of the fourth order leads to ghosts, and that's not necessarily the case. For example, in F of R, that it's not, there's no ghosts there. So that's what I'm saying is that. The reason you would have been nervous about ghosts, well, that I was nervous about ghosts, is I saw this as a fourth order theory, but that's, you need to check. You need to check,
yeah,
and I haven't.
It's only a suspicion condition,
it's not necessarily necessary. Well, I think ghosts usually define at that level, and they could be non-perturbative. It's a good thing that you don't.
Well, I'm thinking that GR is not bound from below, but then it generates a black hole, and then.
If you linearize, Okay. Anyway, let's not worry about ghosts right now because I don't have anything more definitive to say about them. But that's what I got there. Okay, so let's just specialize to the case of static sources and impose a gauge. And then we find this following solution for the metric perturbation like that. So we get a we see that the metric perturbation explicitly sourced by this A tensor and this B tensor here. The B tensor was the ordinary stress energy tensor. So here we see something that gives us like something like an inverse square law. And here we see something that gives us something like a long-range gravitational force. So our solution for the metric perturbations have these two components here, something that looks like something familiar, and then this long-range gravitational force, which is a bit mysterious. Now, it's actually quite mysterious what's going on here, because if you recall, I told you that B alpha beta was essentially the ordinary stress energy tensor. It was the variation of the matter Lagrangian with respect to the metric like so. So this is what you would have an ordinary associated with ordinary matter. Yet we're seeing here that this is sourcing a long-range gravitational interaction. Ordinary matter seems to be sourcing something long-range. Whereas this other field here, which I should have written down, was the variation with respect to these L transformations. And that's what's giving us the inverse square law. Mm-hmm.
Long-range force
would
affect the solution for binary
forces. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Make it zero.
Or make it very small. So you could bound it in some way, shape, or form. But you're right. This is weird. This is odd. This is actually an indication that we're expanding around the wrong background. So I'd like to return to that a bit later. So
it's also going to affect the calculation of gravitational waveforms.
Yeah.
These are static.
But the Green's function's the same. The Green's function is of that same form.
Sure.
There, yeah. So this doesn't change a lot.
Yeah, but I think the problem is you go back to the same problem you have. I mean, these are all the features of my gravity. Like, you get
yeah.
The same thing. The thing is that you have these additional modes, which I guess goes fairly in the case of my gravity. So that's why I guess one makes us fix this.
Yeah, so this is the familiar one from Weyl gravity. This one's a bit different, though. To actually get in a straight Weyl gravity, you don't get this term unless you add other stuff in. So in Mannheim's theory, he wouldn't get this term unless he adds some rather non-singular sources.
Mannheim has always been a problem.
Sorry?
Mannheim's theory
has ghosts.
It has ghosts because it's
yeah.
The driving of the Weyl gravity.
Yeah, so that's...
Inescapable.
Yeah, he doesn't say it's inescapable. But this is not Mannheim's theory. This is based on second-order field equations with different. It looks like Mannheim's theory. I know the precise differences are interesting, but we don't believe it's Mannheim's theory.
The force will then have a constant additional term, right?
Yeah, a constant additional term with this.
Can that not be interpreted as a kind of cosmological?
Yeah, so this motivates you to look at the cosmological sector of this theory, because you're seeing something here that's saying a long-range gravitational force, constant. It kind of smells like a cosmological constant, right? So why don't we look at the cosmological sector is kind of the next thing to do, right? So let's refocus on those nonlinear equations, make some simplifying assumptions, and get to the cosmological sector.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
How do you get this theory has to have a spatial solution somewhere?
Yeah. I'll get back to that. Yeah. Let me get back to that. I think Schwarzschild is the solution of the previous equations, but Schwarzschild de Sitter will be the solution of one that I'll present in just a second. So I'll get back to the black holes in a sec. Not in any significant way, but anyway. Okay, I'm going to make some assumptions in the full nonlinear theory. As I said, these equations of motions are complicated. Let's make some simplifying assumptions. I already told you about the gauge choice. I'm going to switch off the torsion completely. That's a gauge invariant statement. So I am considering a reduced sector of the solution space, but it's a gauge invariant sector of the solution space. That is, I can't do a gauge transformation and reintroduce the torsion. I'm also going to make this technical assumption, which is this script F tensor is also going to vanish as well, which is gauge invariant. And the matter action is going to explicitly only depend on the metric, the generators of special conformal transformations, and matter field psi. Q is the Weyl vector. It is the component of the gauge the gauge vector parallel to the generator of dilatations. Yes. Yeah. So I've imposed a gauge. I still have a gauge symmetry. So this is the 15 generators of the conformal group, but I've been working in a gauge.
SO4.
Yeah. This is SO4 too.
So does any of these assumptions regarding the derivative of E?
No, I don't think so.
So you're not assuming the metric?
Yeah, am I assuming? So do I actually have a metric coming out of that? Yeah.
You're giving space for the generated metric.
Yeah. Does it in some way?
What is the question?
Does any of these assumptions involve the invertibility of E? So I guess your worry is that given if someone hands you a tetrad immediately, does that lead to a metric description that has an inverse or something along those lines? Yeah, I'm not sure about that, actually. So will we have solutions of this in which E is not invertible? I'm not sure. It's a good question. However, I'm going to tell you one in which it is invertible. So with these assumptions, the equations of motion are a bit less complicated. They look like this. B here is the Bok tensor. It's a tensor that shows up often in conformal gravity. It's something involving fourth order metric derivatives. T mu nu is the familiar stress energy tensor, which I've stopped calling B, and I'm going to call it just the regular stress energy tensor. A mu nu is this tensor that characterizes the coupling of matter to the special conformal transformations. Again, it's the variational derivative of the matter action with respect to L. And Q mu nu is something I'm not writing down. It's a tensor quadratic in the Ricci-Weyl and A mu nu tensors. It's fairly complicated, but it's that.
Yep. Why gravity have the Bach tensor and then the stress tensor, and do you guess I don't have the rest of them?
You don't have that, and you don't have that. Yeah, this is the extra stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, but so it's that if you just turn off some of these fields, then you recover a vial.
Yeah, if you turn off some things, you will get vial gravity is a corner of this theory for sure. Yeah. Yeah, and it still has the local conformal transformations, again, assuming appropriate transformations of the T and A and diffeomorphisms. So what's the cosmological sector? So I want to solve those equations, assuming FRW metric ansatz of that type. As soon as I assume this ansatz, and I want the A mu nu, which is, again, this coupling of the matter to this L generator of special conformals, must have this form here to be consistent with cosmological symmetries. So that is any symmetric tensor has to have of that form to be consistent with the background symmetries. There's a couple of field equations that were up on that last slide that the A mu nu tensor has to satisfy. It has to be divergenceless, and its trace has to be covariantly constant as well, which basically fixes what these Xe fields are. They have to be of that form there. So in other words, the cosmological symmetries plus these equations that A has to satisfy fix the form of A completely in terms of a couple of integration constants, pi and lambda, and you can all guess what lambda is going to turn out to be. I want to just take a second stress this point, though. The cosmological symmetries have basically fixed A mu nu to be of that form. It can't take any other form than that. And it's worthwhile emphasizing that anything interesting I'm going to tell you about the cosmological solutions flows from the values of these integration constants here. So the only freedom that there is in A mu nu is the specification of these two dimensionful constants, pi and lambda, and that's where all the interesting effects are going to come from. Yep.
C1 and C2 to refer to density and pressure.
Yeah, except A mu nu doesn't have the dimension.
Density equals pressure. There's no differentiation.
Density equals pressure. I mean, this. Yeah, this looks like radiation. This looks like
it's not
the perfect fluid energy. It's a combination of two perfect fluid energy stress energy tensors. It's one for cosmological constant plus another for radiation.
Okay,
yeah. No. So it's two perfect fluids. You can think of the A mu nu as two perfect fluids. Sir? Next slide. You mean ordinary matter, right? Ordinary matter, yeah. So here I'm going to assume that these guys are both positive for technical reasons. I'll tell you why later. But this is that. I mean these constants are both positive. Here's the ordinary matter. There's still the ordinary stress energy tensor sitting around, and I'm just going to fix that to be matter and dust and radiation to do this model. So it's only that A mu nu tensor that had that format. Okay, so we get an effective Friedman equation coming out of this. So we've made that dust and radiation. We've fixed the A mu nu tensor, and it all looks like that. So we can pull out things that we're interested in. This looks a little bit like dark energy sitting over there. It's a dark energy type term. This looks like a radiation contribution to my Friedman equation, but it's coming with the wrong sign. So it comes somewhat like in brain world models, where you can have this dark radiation term, and it can come with either positive or negative density. This term is somewhat non-standard in that this looks okay. This is a constant over here, but you've got this denominator down here, which is explicitly time dependent. So you've got something that looks like what would you call this? You would call this the density of a cosmological constant plus a radiation, but it's showing up in the denominator down there. So it is something that's a little bit strange, but we notice that if we take the a goes to infinity limit, the late time limit, it's not so strange. Then we've just got these combination of constants there, which we can identify as the Planck mass. So in terms of the late time limit, when a is bigger than that, we can rewrite the Friedmann equation in a very familiar format like that, where we made the identification of the Planck mass in terms of this lambda and Yang-Mills coupling constant like so. So that is, we'll recover a standard lambda CDM cosmology at late times, provided we fix the Yang-Mills coupling in that sense. So, sorry?
Planck mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's 1 over 8 pi g. Yeah, this is going to, so the Yang-Mills constant, so I'm going to have a very uncomfortable number coming into this of 10 to the minus 120. So basically, I'll tell you what it is now. So take that to be the Planck mass squared and take lambda to be the observational value. It's going to imply a value of the Yang-Mills coupling constant of 10. Yeah, it fixes GYM. To 10 to the minus 120, so some ridiculous number. But there's nothing one can, nothing this model can do about that hierarchy of scales. There's nothing in this model to address that hierarchy problem. Is that what you're at?
Unless it's a severe constraint between where?
Yeah, it's gonna be fixed. Yeah, it's gonna be significant for the theory, which I think ultimately is probably gonna, you know, rip apart the theory, but it hasn't yet in anything we've calculated. I'll show you in a sec, okay? Yeah. Okay, so we recover standard lambda CDM at late time. What happens at early time? Let me rewrite the Friedmann equation in terms of this time-dependent Newton's constant. So I'm just rewriting this thing in this way, where I put all this stuff together and made it into some sort of, as I said, time-dependent Newton's constant in terms for interpretation. And then what you can see is at early times, A is going to zero. So this effective Newton's constant is going to go to zero at early times. So what you have here is effective screening of the gravitational influence of ordinary matter at early times. The G effective is going to zero, so the contribution here is less than it would be in ordinary general relativity. So you get screening of matter at early times. So furthermore, what exactly happens in early times? Well, this thing goes like 8 to the fourth at early times. Radiation blows up like 1 over 8 to the fourth at early times. So this whole term goes constant. This term dominates and goes to negative infinity. So this thing goes to a positive constant. This goes to negative infinity. That must be positive. What that immediately is telling you is that there's a range of scale factors around zero which are forbidden classically. So you can't get to A equals zero with this equation. So you can't have a big bang in this model with pi non-zero. That means there's either a cosmological bounce or maybe there's an Einstein static past attractor in the model. So to sort that out, you can just run some simulations and solve the Friedmann equation numerically. So I'll define the usual cosmological parameters in the usual way, like so. I've added an extra one for this pi parameter here. This one is going to take the value for lambda CDM. And I'm going to take just concordance values for all of these usual parameters for the purposes of the simulations. And you get a bounce. So it's fairly straightforward. You take these values for the density parameters, and you get a cosmological bounce at early times. Hard to read these here, sorry about that. That's 10 to the minus 4, and that's 10 to the minus 6 for the omega lambda parameter, like so. So we get a cosmological bounce at early times, and the scale factor at the bounce is basically scales like this omega pi parameter, the square root of that omega pi parameter.
Question, you can get a bounce if you find one of the positive energies.
Yeah, so that's that wrong sign, dark radiation. Yeah, yeah.
It's like GR.
It's like GR with funny matter. Yeah, I'm not quite there yet. Yeah, so to fit the CMB, I'm going to need to know something about the quantum perturbations and something about inflation in this model. Oh, okay, you mean the evolution, say fix some spectrum of perturbations at the end of inflation and then forward. What I would like to do is push this value of this bounce back before at significantly high energies. So I'm hoping that that would be okay, but the perturbation calculation is something that we've got to do.
So is there some choice of parameters you can choose where you recover the perturbation?
Well, you could just... Yeah, you could send a omega pi equal to zero and get precisely lambda CDM. Yeah, so you can just set that's precisely lambda CDM, and there's no bounce there. There's a big bang. Okay, I guess I should probably hurry up. I guess. Okay. Yeah. Just want to mention that after every cosmological bounce, there's a period of accelerated expansion. So if you have some cosmological bounce that goes like that, the scale factors concave up. That means A double dot is positive. So you get some sort of accelerated expansion around any bounce.
So why did you choose the sign of pi so that it's density? You have to choose the sign of the
bounce. Sorry, yeah. Here, to avoid a divergence in the past, like so. So if pi was negative, then this thing would blow up at some finite scale factor. While that might be interesting, that's not the case we chose to study here. That's why. Yeah. You call that a big rip when that happens? That's a big rip, right? When, I think so. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, at finite scale factor. Every cosmological bounce, there's an inflationary period of some type with accelerated expansion. What kind of inflationary period do we get? The easiest way to do that is plot the Hubble factor as a function of scale factor. The Hubble parameter is a function of scale factor like this. That's what it looks like for some value of omega pi, 10 to the minus 20. You can see I'm choosing omega pi to be small because I wanted to push these effects way into the past. And if I took omega pi to be zero, then I'd get lambda CDM directly. So what does this plot tell us? Well, at late times, the Hubble parameter is approximately constant. That's our late time acceleration epoch. So that's the dark energy part, that's fine. This bit down here, when the Hubble factor is decaying, parameter is decaying, we have radiation and matter domination as usual. There's some transition between the two here that's kind of hard to see. Here, where the logarithm of h is going to minus infinity, h is going to zero, that's the bounce. So that's when a dot over a is equal to zero. So we've got the bounce. And in between the bounce and the radiation and matter domination, we have something that looks an awful lot like slow roll inflation. That is a period of accelerated expansion where the Hubble factor is approximately equal to constant. So in loop quantum cosmology, you get a bounce, for example. And after that bounce, you can ask yourself, is that a good inflationary period? And it has a lot of different properties to it that aren't like this. It turns out in this model, after the bounce, we do get this period that looks an awful lot like quasi-de Sitter inflation. So which is... Everybody's asking the questions on the next slide, so yeah. So when does that occur? So that getting back to that Friedman equation, what are the conditions under which that equation occurs? We need the radiation to dominate the matter, that's fine. And we also need this term to dominate that term so that the ratio of these become constant. We also get this phase when these two terms are negligibly small. So when these guys can be neglected with respect to this constant, with this constant contribution, you can get this quasi-de Sitter inflation. So if you put those conditions together, you get the condition for inflation is this, that basically it happens when the scale factors are in between these two ranges. And you can re-express these in a covariant density way if you like. I wouldn't want you to think that it's just something that depends on, it's not diffeomorphism invariant. So this is the condition for inflation. This is basically when the bounce happens. This is when the quasi-de Sitter inflation ends. So now you can say, how many e-foldings do you get? It depends on your value of omega pi. So if omega pi is small, you can get lots of them. And if it's big, you don't get many of them. And you can certainly get 66 if you'd like. So if you take omega pi of order of the Yang-Mills coupling constant squared, that's what you get. The energy scale for inflation using observational values for the other parameters is 10 to the 17 GeV, again, depending on what omega pi and the Yang-Mills coupling constant is as well. So that's somewhat high scale, but that's what you get. But the real kicker is, what is the Yang-Mills coupling in this theory? It's given to you, and you don't really have a choice about it. It has to be a ratio of the observed cosmological constant to the Planck mass squared. There's a huge hierarchy of scales there, so we do get this 10 to the minus 120 sitting in here. So if we were to try and realize something like 66 in e-folds of inflation, we would have to have this pi parameter being incredibly small, omega pi parameter being incredibly small.
First, what is the inflation? What do you mean by e? Is that the hour constant, or is that
the energy scale of inflation? It's yeah, the effective density of whatever it is. Make sense? Yeah.
There is an upper bound on that, I guess, from tensor models,
right? You need a model of inflation, I guess, for it, or? Yeah, so that's assuming that perturbations work the same way in this model, which is not entirely clear.
You probably want to have that tensor way of this thing then.
Yeah.
To get the spectrum index, and there's 0.96, you need an logarithmic correction.
Yeah, so we'd have to have some sort. We'd have to have some running in that quasi-de Sitter phase. And that would need to be calculated. But one thing we don't have a handle on right now is just the behavior of perturbations in the model. So let me talk about that first. So if it was a conventional inflationary model with a conventional behavior of perturbations and things like that, I could go that way, but I'm not sure that we're even there yet.
This is an incredibly small one.
This is the life of this model. It's the hierarchy, and also, I think I say it right here. They have the same naturalist problem as, you know, anything that can't explain the hierarchy between the Planck mass and the observed cosmological constant. Can't do anything about that. The new cosmological constant problem, not the old one. Okay. So I'll quickly talk about this because it's work in progress and I'm not sure if any of it's right. Cosmological case. We found this AMU nu tensor was of this format like that. And it turned out that this term here was rather crucial for everything. So this is the term here, this lambda, that introduced a scale into the problem, a dimensionful scale that broke the conformal symmetry of the gravitational model and allowed us to recover Newton's constant. So this is a very Higgsy-like thing where we expect some sort of spontaneous, we could expect some sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking of the conformal symmetry mediated by this mediated by this tensor like that. And that's what generates the Newton's constant. generates a dimensionful Newton's constant. Other than, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have any dimensionful Newton's constant coming in there. So really it's coming from this term, like so. This means that when we were linearizing before, we were expanding around a vacuum that had a mu nu equals zero. That might not have been the correct thing to expand around. In that, what I'm saying here is that we're going to need this term to regenerate Newton's constant in the model and break conformal symmetry. It's likely that the correct vacuum for this theory then is the one that has a mu nu equals lambda g mu nu. So let's go ahead under that assumption. So this is rather different from the ansatz used in the linear analysis above. So I'm going to just add this assumption to our previous ones. This is all we did before, so we had all these things. All I'm going to do is put in, basically you can somewhat uncharitably say I'm just writing in a cosmological constant, but I have a reason to think that it might be, that might be the right vacuum for this model. But I'm going to put it into these equations. And when we do that, we obtain the following field equation, which is the entire field equation for that model there. So what is this here? So here we see the usual Einstein tensor showing up. Here we see the usual cosmological constant term showing up. There's the stress energy tensor of ordinary matter. This thing is supposed to conspire to give me the Planck mass, and this is the extra stuff that shows up in here. It involves the Bach tensor and quadratic function of the Weyl tensor, like so. So this is the theory that I get when I assume a mu nu takes that background.
Can I ask a question? So what made lambda to be constant? What made it constant? Why? Is that the only solution?
That was the only solution from the cosmological case. That was the only one that was allowed. I wasn't allowed to make it. Yeah, that pi there. So the cosmological symmetry forced a mu nu to be in that particular form. Sorry.
Why would it, I mean, cosmological symmetry tells you it has a tensor alpha, or it could be a time function of time. So why is it a function of time?
Well, you needed, so you needed that it was conserved. So a mu nu was conserved. That's not the only thing, though. But you needed that its trace was covariantly conserved as well. And when the trace was covariantly conserved, that's all you can do. You can just have radiation plus cosmological constant. That's it.
Okay,
so this theory that we ended up with that vacuum, does have a Schwarzschild de Sitter solution, so you can just verify that Schwarzschild de Sitter is a solution of this. So in that sense, we've got some, it is a solution of the model, and one has some hope then that this would all be consistent with, say, solar system tests, because Schwarzschild de Sitter is a great metric for describing physics in our solar. There could be, I don't know if Birkhoff's theorem holds.
Sure.
Yeah, there is a literature of this on statically spherically symmetric solutions of Bach equals zero. So I believe there are some of those out there. I'm not sure about this theory particularly, but it could very well be that there are more of them. So if Birkhoff theorem falls apart, then there's gonna be, that's interesting.
You have to worry about it.
Yeah, we would have to worry about that. Yeah.
So for the solution, the whole term of parentheses is zero?
Yeah, it's just zero. Yeah. It's weird, but it is. Bach is equal to zero, and Schwarzschild de Sitter, this all conspires to be equal to zero. So that's just suggestive. It's not saying, you know, that solar system tests are satisfied. It's just suggestive. But there's probably going to be deviations in gravitational waves, because as soon as I get away from that, this is going to be some sort of contribution to gravitational waves, which might be an interesting way to go first and just look at the dynamical gravity situation here. You're going to get contributions that could very well rule this out.
Propagation speed could change as well.
Sorry?
Propagation speed might not be that of light.
Yeah, well, it can only be that. So you could have a propagation So you kind of get a fourth order term and a second order term. It looks like there's one massless mode that propagates, and then there's another mode that's a massive mode, but it has mass of order the Hubble scale or something like that, because it's the only Hubble scale there. So I don't think that one would necessarily be constrained directly. I think what might be possible is that there's like some overproduction of gravitational waves, and LIGO would have already seen like huge amounts of gravitational waves from sources we already know, which is a calculation.
So, GR has 2 degrees of polarization.
Mm-hmm.
Gravitational waves. How many do you know?
Okay, this is why this is work in progress. The linear analysis around flat space had 2 degrees of polarization, just like GR. There was no scalar degree of freedom sitting around or anything like that. This one I'm not sure about.
There's a potential ghost you would have more than two.
Yeah. So that's something to, yeah.
So, okay. Are these equations different from those of Weyl gravity?
Yeah, Weyl gravity would be B equal T alpha beta.
Have the C squared, which
Well, and don't neglect this guy here.
If you just add R, I just have different Weyl gravity, then you get those.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but that kind of violates the spirit of Weyl gravity, of course, if one were to add Einstein-Hilbert directly. But yeah, you don't get these terms in Weyl gravity.
It seems like what you're doing is you're kind of spontaneously breaking the outcome of symmetry by adding.
Yes. Yeah.
So in some sense, what you're doing the same thing, yeah, why they make the symmetry by choosing a value for A.
Yes, and I should mention that Mannheim does have a version of Weyl gravity with a complicated matter coupling that does generate these Einstein-Hilbert terms as well around some sort of background solution. So I think that was close to the spirit of what we're doing here. What I'm saying there is you take Weyl gravity and you add a fairly complicated matter coupling to it, and from that it tends to mimic some solution like this, which is like the spontaneous symmetry breaking of his theory.
It's like R-squared theory plus Einstein. Lots of papers on that.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, this is where we're at with this guy. We'd like to understand the linearization of this, and the theory might go away rather quickly once we deal with that. If it didn't go away rather quickly after that, then we'd be looking at the cosmological perturbations and things like that that you were mentioning earlier. Okay, so let me just summarize then quickly. I think I've gone a little over time anyway. We looked at Yang-Mills gravity. It was based on the conformal group. We have the linear theory in Minkowski space has this long-range gravitational force, motivated us to look at the cosmological solutions that had all these features, bounce, some possibly long-lived quasi-de Sitter inflation and late-time acceleration. We don't really have any explanation of why the observed cosmological constant is so small in Planck units. That's something that we take for input from observations. And then the next steps would be the classical and quantum cosmological perturbations, the linear theory about the de Sitter backgrounds, looking at gravitational waves, and so on and so forth. Thanks.
Sorry, I asked so many questions. In the 60s,
mm-hmm.
Young published a paper in the Review of Lenses called Yang Gravity.
Yang published a paper. Yeah, okay, right.
There are a lot of papers in the 60s and also in the early 70s.
Okay, what was his model or was it?
Physical review.
Okay.
Kilobits and all sorts. So I wonder what happened to that.
That's not one I'm familiar with. I gave the references to Uchiyama and Kibble in those who have kind of... Okay, yeah, that'd be good.
There's a long history.
There is a long history of that. There does seem to be an interesting history where one writes down a lot of these theories and rarely solves the equations. Sometimes they do get solved. But there's lots of papers where the equations of motion are written down.
That history hasn't changed.
So my question is, I always ask this, why are you doing this?
Oh, that's a good question. Somebody came in my office one day and said, no. The motivation of this, one of the original motivations was some sort of quantum gravity theory, where you could get something that looked classically like general relativity, but then had some sort of dimensionless coupling constant. So maybe it's perturbatively renormalizable. So that was like one of the ancient motivations, or not really ancient motivations, it's one of the motivations. Now, you might say, that's great, you haven't even attempted to quantize this theory, or anything like that, and I would say that's completely right. It takes a life of its own classically after some point. So it's a model that has some sort of realization of dark energy, but ultimately it's not very much different from lambda CDM. It's just a constant. There's nothing evolving there. There'd be very hard to observationally pick it out.
Two big mysteries to solve.
No, I don't say anything about dark matter. It's possible that the linear analysis might have something to say about that. Especially with that long-range gravitational force, but it could have something to say about that for sure.
So is the fact that you're getting the Yang-Gale's coupling constant so small, does that mean that that long-range force is very much suppressed, or what restrictions in that long-range force is
really? That would come from the solution of this equation, and it's something we're looking into yet, but I'm not willing to say anything just yet.
Okay, this makes about 34 questions.
Yeah, yes. We do get, in this case, we do get a massive mode.
Yeah, I think we do. We're going to get a massive mode, like the massive graviton in De Sitter that has a...
Okay, so the mass related to lambda.
Yeah. It's the only length scale that can come into it, right?
Yeah,
it can't be anything other than lambda.
It's the conformal break.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can see that just by looking at this. There's nothing else it could be.
Okay, I think Sanjeev.
Okay.